and it wasn't his to worry about anymore. Nice and clear. Peter often wished that responsibility had such bright, tall fences around it off the ball field, too. When Peter's mother had died, he'd gone for a while to a therapist. At 7 years old, he hadn't wanted to talk, or maybe he just hadn't known how to shrink that kind of loss into words. The therapist, a kind-eyed woman with a long silver braid, said that was okay. That was perfectly okay. And for the whole session, Peter would pull little cars and trucks from a toy box. There must have been hundreds of them in there. Peter figured later the woman had cleaned out a toy store for him, and crashed them together two by two. When he was finished, she would always say the same thing. That must have been hard for you. Your mom gets in a car to go buy groceries, a regular day, and she never comes home. Peter never answered, but he remembered a sense of rightness about those words, and about the whole hour, as if he was finally where he should be, and there was nothing else he should be doing except crashing those little cars and hearing that it must have been hard for him. Until one day, the therapist said something else. Peter, do you feel angry? No, he said quickly. Never. A lie. And then he'd gotten off the floor and taken a single green apple Jolly Rancher from the brass bowl by the door. Exactly the way he did at the end of every session. That was the deal the kind-eyed therapist had made with him. Whenever he'd had enough, he could take a candy and the session would be over. And left. But outside, he'd kick the candy into the gutter, and on the way home, he told his father he wasn't going back again. His father hadn't argued. In fact, it had seemed a relief to him. But not to Peter. Had the nice therapist known all along he'd been angry that last day, that he'd done something terrible, that as punishment, his mother hadn't taken him to the store? And did she blame him for what happened? A few months later, Peter had gotten Pax. He'd come across a fox run over by the side of the road near his house. So soon after watching his mother's coffin lowered into the ground, he'd felt an unshakable need to bury the body. As he'd looked around for a good place, he'd found the den, filled with three cold, stiff-kit bodies, and one little ball of gray fur, still warm and breathing. He tucked Pax into his sweatshirt pocket, and brought him home, and said, not asked, said, I'm keeping him. His dad had said, okay, okay, for a while. The kit mewed piteously all through the night, and hearing him, Peter had thought that if he could visit the kind-eyed therapist again, he'd smash those toy cars together all day and all night forever. Not because he was angry, just to make everybody see. Thinking about Pax made the old anxiety snake tighten around Peter's chest. He needed to get moving again, make up some time. The practice was breaking up now. Boys loping in from the field, shedding equipment as they streamed past the dugout. As soon as the field was clear, he dropped from the bleachers, pulled his backpack down, and hitched it over his shoulders. Just as he set out along the diamond, though, he saw the shortstop. Peter hesitated. He should take off, try to blend in with the stragglers leaving the school grounds. But the rest of the team had left this kid to bag up the equipment and walk back alone. And Peter knew how that felt. He picked up a couple of balls and handed them over. Hey. The boy took the balls with a cautious smile. Hey. Nice play. That last liner? That ball had hair. The boy looked away and scuffed at the dirt, but Peter could see he was pleased. Yeah, well, the first baseman made it look cleaner than it was. Nah, you planted that ball. Your first baseman would be lucky to catch a cold by himself, no offense. The boy gave Peter a real grin. Yeah, coach's nephew. You play? Peter nodded. Center field. You new here? Oh, I don't live here, I... Peter nodded his head vaguely south. Hampton? Yeah, Hampton, right. The boy's face closed. Scouting before Saturday's game? Jerk. He spat and walked back to the dugout. As he left the school grounds, Peter congratulated himself on his quick thinking, covering his runaway tracks. But somehow he felt kind of bad anyway. Somehow, he felt lousy, actually. He shrugged the feeling off. What was it his dad said about feelings? Something about a quarter and a cup of coffee? And checked his watch. 4:15. He'd lost over 3 hours. Peter pressed faster, but when he came to the town square again, he crossed to the opposite side from the hardware store and forced himself to walk at an even pace, past a library, past a bus station, past a diner. Then he counted off 1,000 steps before he risked lifting his head. When he did, he checked his watch again. 4:50. His grandfather was probably packing up his stuff now. Peter imagined him walking to his rusty blue Chevy, fitting the key into the ignition. And with that image, his anxiety struck, knocking the breath right out of him. He scaled a low wooden fence and dropped into scrubby brush. He pushed in a good safe 30 feet until the saplings rose up taller than he was, until his anxiety let him breathe right again, before turning to parallel the road. It was rougher going now, but 15 minutes later he reached it, the highway. Peter shadowed the entrance ramp, crouching low, then, at a break in traffic, ran down the culvert, scaled the chain-link fence, and dropped to the other side, his heart beating hard. He'd made it. He loped into the trees, keeping an eye out for a likely place to cut west, and in just a few minutes, he found one. A dirt road running perpendicular to the highway. Well, not much more than an old wagon path, to be honest. But it was heading in the right direction and would be easy walking, even at night. He turned in. For a short while, the trees beside him grew denser as he walked, and only bird calls and squirrel rustlings broke the silence. Peter realized he might have seen the last of civilization for a while. The thought lifted him. But a few minutes later, the road turned a corner and began to run along an old pasture dotted with gnarled fruit trees and ragged bloom. A stone wall bordered the field, and a low barn stood at the far corner. There were no lights on in the barn, no car or truck beside it. Still, Peter's heart crashed. The barn looked freshly painted, and some of the roof shingles were the raw pink of new wood. This was the road to someone's home. Worse, it might lead to a bigger road the atlas had been too old to show. In any case, it wasn't a shortcut across the hills. Peter dropped his pack and sank into a narrow jog in the stone wall. Exhausted and starving. He tugged his boots off and peeled down his socks. 2 bad blisters throbbed on each heel. They were going to kill when they broke. Peter dug out his extra pair of socks from the bottom of the backpack and worked them on over the first pair. He rested his head back against the rough stone, still giving off a little warmth from the day's sun, which was now hovering just over the line of trees, bathing the field in a peach-colored glow. He pulled the raisins out and ate them one at a time, taking small sips of water in between. Then he opened 2 packets of string cheese and took 4 crackers from the sleeve. He ate as slowly as he could, watching the sun over the orchard, surprised to find that he could actually mark its sinking movement. How had he lived 12 years and never known this about sunsets? Peter laced his boots. Just as he started to rise, he caught sight of a deer, which bounded into the orchard from the woods beyond. He held his breath as the orchard filled, 14 deer in all. They began to graze, and a few nibbled delicately at the low branches of the trees. Peter squatted back down, and the closest one, a doe, with a spindly spotted fawn beside her, turned her head to look directly at him. Peter raised his palm slowly, hoping to let her know he meant no harm. The doe moved between Peter and her fawn, but after a while she dipped her head into the grass again, and then the clear twilight air was split by the screech of a saw biting through wood from behind the barn. The herd startled in unison and peeled away into the darkening woods, their white tails flashing. Before she bounded off, the doe sent another look straight at Peter, one that seemed to say, "You humans, you ruin everything." Peter took off. Back at the highway, half the cars had their headlights on now, and it seemed they were all trained directly on him. He ducked off the road. The ground was spongy and smelled of peat. He was just debating about risking the flashlight when his foot sank with a splash. He grabbed an overhanging branch and pulled himself out, but it was too late. He could feel cold swamp water seeping into his boots. Peter cursed. Not bringing more socks, another mistake. It had better be the last of the trip. And then, clambering back to higher ground, he made another, much worse mistake. His right foot caught on a root and he fell. He heard the bone break, a soft, muffled snap. At the same time, he felt the sharp stab. He sat, panting with the stunning pain for a long moment. Finally, he pulled his foot free and unlaced his boot, wincing at each motion. He eased down the wet socks, and what he saw made him gasp. His foot was swelling so fast that he could actually see it. Peter rolled his socks back up, nearly crying out at the pain it caused, then gritted his teeth to work his foot back into the boot before it could swell any more. He crawled to a tree and pulled himself upright. He tested his weight on his foot and nearly collapsed again. The pain was far worse than anything he'd felt before. It made the broken thumb feel like a mosquito bite in comparison. He couldn't walk. Chapter 7. Pax squirmed in pleasure at the solid, warm weight of another's body nestled against his. Half awake, he sniffed to draw in the comforting scent of his boy. Instead of human, though, he found Fox. He woke fully then, curled against him. Snoring was the vixen's brother. Runt whimpered and fluffed his tail over his snout, still asleep. Pax pulled himself up sharply. He had no practice at dominance, but the situation left him no choice. "Go back to your den." When Runt tried to nestle his chest, Pax nipped him on the shoulder. Runt shook himself awake and rolled to his feet. He didn't duck his head in submission, and he made no move to leave. "Play," his position invited instead. In other circumstances, Pax would have welcomed the good-natured little fox's company, but he had no interest in tangling with Bristle again, and in fact, he had no interest in anything besides getting back to his humans. Pax fetched the plastic soldier he'd cached and dropped it as an offering, then warned him away again. After a final pleading look, Runt took the toy in his mouth. Pax followed him out and watched until he slipped into a hole a few tail lengths away. When the thunderstorm had hit, short but violent, with whole sheets of sky splitting open in wrathful cracks, Pax had worked his way into the shallow entrance of an abandoned den, not far from the one Bristle shared with her brother before taking measure of his surroundings. Now, in the pale light of the half-moon, he took a moment to survey them. The hillside faced south. Here, the roots of the trees seemed to claw at the sandy soil like the brown knuckles of clenched fists. Tucked among them, Pax saw three den entrances. Above this hillside, the forest rose to the north and west, back to the road. Below, a vast grassy valley sloped away. It was an ideal location. The hillside perch provided little cover for approaching predators, while the line of trees protected the foxes from the north winds. The meadow smelled abundantly of life. As Pax took all this in, a tension deep within him loosened. It was the same way he'd felt as a kit, when after he'd pushed his food dish to the farthest corner of his boy's nest room three times, Peter had finally understood to leave it there, away from the cold north wall, and with a view of the door where the father entered, sometimes in anger. Safe. But this place was not safe for him. Bristle had warned him that in this same meadow lived an older fox and his mate. He was already facing a challenger from outside and would not tolerate the presence of another lone male. And just then, Pak saw a movement below him. A broad-shouldered alpha with black and gray fur emerged from the brush halfway down the slope and marked a sapling beside him. The big fox began to groom, but with a paw still to his ear, he suddenly pricked his snout into the breeze. Pak bolted up the hill and plunged into the forest undergrowth. He picked up his own scent easily, although it had rained hard. Stopping only for quick licks of water from the leaves, he followed it back to the road. There, Pak caught the lingering scent of the military transport caravan from the day before, but no other traffic had passed since then. He settled himself on the fallen oak trunk, again, to wait. Morning brought the shimmery buzz of insect clouds and the chatter of waking birds, but still no traffic sounds on the road. As the sun rose hot and dry, it burned off the rain droplets that had hung from every green shoot. Pak was aware of his hunger now, but his thirst was worse. He'd had nothing to drink since leaving his human's house. His throat was parched and his tongue swollen and thick. He felt dizzy whenever he shifted his position. 100 times a thin scent of water drifted past him, but he never considered abandoning his post for its promise. His humans would come back here. He dug his claws into the wood and strained for the sound of a vehicle on the silent road. An hour passed, and then another. Pak dozed and woke and remembered. Dozed and woke and remembered. And then the wind brought news of something approaching. A fox. The same male he'd seen earlier. The one Bristle had warned him about. The fox's gait was deliberate, showing neither hesitation nor wasted energy. The way his grayed coat draped his frame announced that he was old. As he drew close, Pak saw that even his eyes were clouded gray with age. After offering his scent, Gray settled himself on the grass beside the fallen trunk. He made no move to elevate himself, indicating that he meant no threat.
"You carry the scent of humans. I lived with them once. They are approaching."
A sudden hope rejuvenated Pak. "Have you seen my boy?" He described Peter. But Gray had seen no humans at all since the time he had lived with them in his youth. And that was in another place. A dry, stony land of long winters and low sun, distant.
"The approaching humans are coming from the west. They are bringing war. The crows who have seen them do not describe any youth."
The news weakened Pak. He swayed and nearly lost his grip on the trunk.
"You need water. Follow me."
Pak hesitated. His humans could come at any time. But his need for water was urgent. "Is it nearby? Can I hear the road from this water?"
"Yes. The stream passes beneath the road. Follow me."
Gray's manner, confident but not threatening, calmed Pak. He dropped from his perch and followed. Soon they came to a deep gash in the earth, from which rose the scents of water and of things that grew in rich mud. Pak peered over the edge and saw a silver brook, studded with black stones, glinting between green reeds and purple blossoms. Gray began to angle down cautiously. Lured by the scent of water, Pak scrambled past him, straight down the cut. Halfway there, he lost his footing and skidded the rest of the way. When he righted himself, he stared. The water tumbled past him as if from a vast faucet, larger by far than even the spout that poured water into the great white tub his boy bathed in. He dipped his head. The water was cold and tasted of copper and pine and moss. It rushed into his mouth as if it were alive. It stung his teeth and drenched his mouth and throat. He drank and drank, and he didn't step away until his belly was taut. Gray joined him, drank, and then invited Pak to rest with him. Pak cocked his head to listen intently to the still silent road above the culvert. "I must be at the road when my humans come for me." Gray eased himself to the ground and stretched out.
That road was blocked yesterday by the war sick.
Pax thought back to the vehicles that had passed the day before, the ones that smelled like his boy's father's new clothing. It was true that the road had been unused since then, but it didn't matter. My boy will return for me there.
No. The crows report this. The road is closed.
Pax paced from stone to stone, thrashing his tail as he worked the puzzle. The answer came. I will go to my boy at our home.
Where is your home?
Pax circled to be sure. Although there was no question, he felt the pull of his home strongly from only one direction. South. Gray didn't seem surprised.
There are vast human colonies there. When the war sick arrive here, my family will have to move nearer to those colonies, or go north, into the mountains. Tell me about the humans there. How they are to live beside.
Again, the old fox's comportment soothed Pax. He came back and sat. I have seen many from a distance, but I know only two.
Are they false acting, like the ones I knew?
Pax did not understand. Gray rose to his haunches, agitated, and shared the behavior he had seen. A human turning away a starving neighbor, acting as if there were no food in his larder when it was full. A human feigning indifference to a mate she'd chosen. A human enticing a sheep from its flock with a soothing voice and then butchering it.
Your humans do not do these things?
Immediately Pax thought of his boy's father pulling him from the car, his voice mimicking a sense of regret Pax knew was false by the burst of lie scent he'd given off. He turned back to the brook. As it spilled over a pair of stones, the current split and then reunited in a liquid silver braid. Pax was struck by a memory. Not long after his boy had rescued him, when he was still a skittish kit, a stranger had come to the door. Pax had watched from under a table, as his boy's father had greeted a woman with a long silver braid streaming over one shoulder. His smile showed all his teeth, which Pax had come to understand, meant, "Welcome, I'm glad to see you, I wish you no harm." But beneath the smile, the man's body was rigid with anger and fear. Pax had been confused by this fear. The small woman was projecting nothing but kindness and concern. She kept repeating the word Pax had already come to associate with his boy, Peter, in a pleading tone. The man's full-teeth welcome smile remained frozen in place, but the room had flooded with the bitter scent of deception as he answered her. His chest had been puffed out in threat as he shut the door hard against her. Pax turned to the older fox. I have seen it. Not in my boy, never in him, but it's true of his father. The old fox seemed to age as he took this in. With visible effort, he rose on his haunches.
Are they still careless?
They were careless where I lived with them.
Careless?
They plow a field, and they slaughter the mice living there. With no warning. They dam a river and leave the fish to die. Are they still careless that way?
Once, when Peter's father was about to cut down a tree, Pax had watched Peter climb it, to take down a nest and move it to another tree. On cold days, Peter brought fresh straw to Pax's pen. Before he himself ate, he always made sure Pax had water and food. My boy is not careless. The old fox seemed relieved by this news, but only for a moment.
When war comes, they will be careless.
What is war? Gray paused.
There is a disease that strikes foxes sometimes. It causes them to abandon their ways, to attack strangers. War is a human sickness like this.
Pax jumped to his feet. The war sick? They will attack my boy.
War came to the land where I lived with humans. Everything was ruined. There was fire everywhere. Many deaths, and not only of the war sick, the adult males. Children, mothers, elders of their own kind.
all the animals. The men who were sick with the disease spilled their chaos over everything in their path.
This same thing is coming?
Gray raised his head in a howl that turned the air itself to sadness.
West of here, where the war is already, where the humans are killing each other,
the land is completely ruined.
The crows carry the news.
The rivers are dammed.
The earth is scorched bare. Not even briars will grow.
Rabbits and snakes, pheasants and mice, all creatures killed.
Pax leaped to the path. He would find his boy, before this war came.
Gray followed.
Wait, I will travel south with you to search for a new home.
Follow me back first.
Back to the meadow? No. The vixen warned me not to return.
The vixen will never welcome you because you have lived with humans.
Pax then caught a quick flash of the same scene he'd watched pass between the vixen and her brother. A cold, howling wind. A mated pair of foxes in great distress. A cage of steel clamps. Blood staining snow. And then, abruptly, nothing.
But she's not dominant. Follow me back.
We will rest and eat, then leave tonight.
Chapter 8. The sound Peter most loved in the world, the leather-to-leather smack of ball and glove, was so real in his dream that he smiled as he opened his eyes. And then yelped in shock. A woman stood over him, tossing a baseball into a glove. She wore patched overalls with faded bandanas, knotted along the straps, and her hair was a spiked mess that shook as she cocked her head to study him. He scrambled backward along rough wooden floorboards, crying out again, this time at the pain shooting up from his right foot. It all came back fast. In rising panic, he looked around for his pack. There it was, behind the woman, its contents strewn across the floor. She came closer and thumped the ball into the glove a little harder. His ball, and his glove, Peter realized. The ball that had been in his pack, the glove he had been sleeping on. He strained up. Hey! That's my stuff! What are you doing here? At that, the woman threw back her head and barked something between a laugh and a snort. She pitched the ball and glove away and crouched down to eye him. One hand wrapped around a clutch of feathers she wore on a rawhide strip around her neck. This close, Peter could see that she wasn't as old as he'd thought. Not much older than his father, anyway. A single gray streak bolted through her hair, but her skin was smooth. When she narrowed her eyes and snapped her fingers at his face, it dawned on him that the woman might be crazy.
No, 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 no. This is my barn you broke into. So what are you doing here, would be my question.
Peter scooted back. Crazy or not, the woman standing over him had a wall full of hatchets and scythes behind her, and he was 1 foot short of a running pair. Okay, right. I hurt my foot last night. I'd passed your barn, and I needed a place to stay, so... Look, I'll go.
Not so fast. What do you mean, you passed my barn? This is... private property, and I'm in the middle of nowhere.
The woman straightened to her full height, and Peter edged back even farther.
I was taking a shortcut home from...
The practice he'd been to the day before flashed before him. He nodded to his ball and glove.
From batting practice.
You were coming home through my land from batting practice?
Then the first thing I'm wondering is why you don't have a bat.
She tossed a hand toward his stuff.
Why you carry a roll of duct tape, garbage bags, and a charm bracelet, clothing, food, and water, but no bat.
Eh, boya?
The way she said boy, silky and stretched out to two syllables, made him realize she had the hint of an accent. Only a hint. As if sometime in her childhood people around her had spoken a language that was close to singing.
Well, I left it. A bat's heavy to carry around.
The woman shook her head again, and this time she looked disgusted. She yanked up the left leg of her overalls. Below the knee, her leg was a rough wooden post. She stabbed it down beside Peter. Now this leg,
Oh, this leg is heavy, boy. Solid heart pine. But I carry it around, don't I? The woman peered down at it and seemed to discover something she didn't much like. She pulled a knife from her belt and with a flick of her wrist shaved off a chink from just above where her ankle would have been. Then she straightened to face Peter again, the knife jabbing directly at him. So let's try one more time, because I am very curious now. If you were at batting practice, how is it you don't have a bat? Peter dragged his gaze up to the woman's face, and then back down to the knife. The blade gleamed long and thin with an evil-looking curve to it. She was probably crazy, all right. Probably worse. His heart stuttered in his chest, and his mouth was a desert. But he managed to answer. I don't own one. The woman flashed half a grin and a quick wink. Better. Yes, that has the feel of truth. What's your name? Peter told her. So, no bat, Peter. What's this about your foot? Peter kept his eyes on the knife as he peeled the sweatshirt from his foot. The pain of just that slight movement shocked him. Shudders racked him, and for the first time he realized how cold he was. I twisted it. The woman crouched down, her wooden leg angled out awkwardly. Peter looked away. Don't move. Before he could even register what was happening, the woman slipped the cool blade of her knife inside his sock, and with a quick stroke, slid it open. He pressed his lips together to keep from crying out. His foot was as dark and swollen as an eggplant. You walked on this? Peter pointed to the branch beside him. I broke it off, made a cane. His finger was shaking. He dropped his hand. The woman nodded again and then cupped her hands around his heel. I'm gonna move this around, she warned. You ready? No, don't touch it! But the woman began to probe his foot, calling commands. Move your big toe. Now all of them. And the foot, side to side. Peter winced at the pain, but he did everything she asked. You're lucky, she said, setting Peter's foot down onto his sweatshirt. A non-displaced fracture of the fifth metatarsal. That's a single clean break in the outermost bone of the foot. Lucky? How is a broken bone lucky? The woman reared back, slammed her wooden leg down near his hand, and then stabbed her blade into the wood. Oh, I don't know. Let's see. How is only a broken bone lucky? Okay, okay. I get it. Sorry. She tugged the knife from her leg and pointed it at him. You're young. You'll be in a cast for maybe 6 weeks. Healed just fine. How do you know this stuff? Are you a doctor or something? I was a medic. Another life. The woman hoisted herself up and looked down at Peter, as if she just put it together. A runaway. She crossed her arms over her chest and cocked her head at him. Yes? Are you running away? No. No, I was just out hiking. She clapped her hands to her ears and frowned. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. My lie detector was going off. Try again. Are you running away from home? Peter sighed. Not exactly. Then what exactly were you doing last night, passing through my land with your extra clothes and your supplies, no bat, Peter? Well, I'm not running away from home. I'm running away to home. Oh, that's a twist. Continue. Peter looked out the window over the workbench. Tall pines pierced a pale morning sky, and a bunch of crows argued noisily in the top branches. If there were a story he could tell that would get him out of this barn and back on the road to Pax, he would tell it. He would disappear into that day, fractured fifth metatarsal and all. But if such a story existed, he couldn't think what it was. He slumped against the wall. The war is heading for our town. They'll take the river. My dad had to go serve. My mom died, so it's just us. So he brought me. How old is this father of yours? What? He's 36. Why? Then he didn't have to do anything. If there's a draft, it's for 18 to 20-year-olds. Still kids, easy to brainwash. So if your father went, He volunteered. It was his choice. Let's start this story off with the truth. That's the rule around here.
Okay, sure. He chose to go, and he brought me to my grandfather's, and... And you didn't like it there.
That wasn't it. It was... Could you put that away? The woman looked down and seemed surprised to find the knife in her hand.
Such bad manners, Vola, she chided herself. We've forgotten how to behave with a guest.
She tossed the knife onto the workbench. Go on.
Okay. I had a fox. I have a fox.
We turned him loose. We left him on the side of the road. My dad said we had to, but I should never have done it. Since the instant they'd driven away, Peter had been tormented by the things he should have said to his father. They all came rushing out now. I raised him from a kit. He trusted me. He won't know how to survive outside. It doesn't matter that he's just a fox, that's what my father calls him, just a fox, as if he's not as good as a dog or something.
Yes, yes. You were plenty angry, so you ran.
I wasn't angry, I'm not... It's that my fox, he depends on me. I'm going to go back and get him.
Well, now you're not. Change of plans.
No, I have to get him and take him home. Peter rolled to his knees, swallowing the gasp of pain that shot from his foot. He grabbed the branch and tried his weight on it for a second, then sank back down, exhausted from just that.
Now? You still think this? How far away did you leave him?
200 miles. Maybe more, Peter admitted. Vola snorted.
You wouldn't make it 2 miles now. You'd be nothing but bear bait out there. That is, if you didn't die of hypothermia the first night. You won't be able to move enough to keep warm.
She leaned back against the workbench, winding a scarf around a finger, and Peter could tell she was trying to figure something out. She didn't look as crazy now, just deep in thought, and maybe worried. Then she seemed to come to a decision.
Someone is bound to come looking for you. I can't have that. I need you gone.
But I can't send you out like this. I have enough on my conscience. I will bind that foot and give you something for the pain, something that's legal to give a child, and then... I'm not a child. I'm almost 13.
Vola shrugged.
And then you will leave. There's a garage not far down the highway. Call this grandfather of yours, have him come and get you.
I'm not going back. I'm going to get my fox.
Not like this, you're not. You cannot bear weight on that broken foot until the bone heals. 6 weeks, at least. Maybe you try again then.
6 weeks? No, that would be too late. My fox!
Remember, boy, I know a little something about traveling on one leg. To get around before that bone heals, you'd have to learn to carry yourself from your shoulders and your arms. You'd have to become strong in new ways, almost impossible for an adult, never mind a child.
I'm not a child!
Vola swept up a silencing hand. So you will go back now and have that broken bone set. But first, I will bind it for you and fix you something better than that branch to walk with. Vola pushed herself off the workbench and left the barn. Peter watched her disappear down a pine-framed path, rolling with a limp so deep that it looked painful. Then he crawled across the floor and stuffed his belongings back into his pack. He pulled himself up to the workbench. The effort made him dizzy, and he had to white-knuckle the wood until his head cleared. His foot throbbed fiercely when he was upright, and by testing it slightly, he knew he wasn't going to be able to walk on it. Vola would bind it, though. He'd be able to walk on it then. He had to. He hoisted himself onto the bench to wait. He hadn't been able to see much of the barn the night before, even with the flashlight. Now he took it in. The floor was swept bare, with bags of seed and fertilizer stacked neatly by the door. The place smelled of clean hay and wood, and not of animals, although he could hear chickens nearby. The workbench took up a whole gable wall of the barn. It was lined with small tools and pieces of wood. Opposite, dark against the bright rectangle of the doorway beside it, draped burlap covered a bunch of things mounted on the wall. Another convulsion of shivers shook him, this time not from the cold. The covered mounds were shaped like human heads. Any number of perfectly harmless things could be hanging on a barn wall, but what they really looked like were human heads. His throat went dry and his heart began to kick hard. He'd been stupid and careless. Probably the crazy woman was going to let him go. Why wouldn't she let him go? But maybe she wasn't. He found the knife she'd left and wrapped his palm around its smooth grip. Vola had the upper hand in whatever was going to happen between them, but that didn't mean he couldn't defend himself. He slid the blade into his pocket just as she appeared in the doorway. "Drink this." She handed Peter a mug and set a bowl beside him. Peter sniffed at the mug. "Cider. There's a measure of willow bark in it, so drink it all."
"Willow bark?"
"Aspirin in the wild." Peter put the mug down. He wasn't going to drink a crazy woman's brew.
"Suit yourself."
Vola took up the bowl, began stirring the green paste inside with her finger. "What's that?"
"Poultice. With arnica for the bruising and comfrey for the broken bone."
She gestured for him to prop his foot on the bench. The poultice felt cool and soothing as she eased it over the hot, tight skin. She untied a bandana from her overall strap and wrapped it around his foot, binding it with a second scarf so that it felt secure. Then she straightened up, wiping her hands on her overalls. "How tall are you?"
5'3". "Why?"
Vola didn't answer. She rummaged through a stack of lumber, brought several long, narrow pieces over to a pair of sawhorses, and began sawing them into paired lengths. The cut wood smelled fresh and clean. As she nailed short boards across the top of two longer ones, Peter understood. Crutches. She was making him a pair of crutches. The knife he'd stolen grew heavier across his thigh. In a few minutes, Vola had angle-braced the top boards and screwed on hand rests. She measured the crutches against him, then sawed an inch off the bottom of each. Then she rolled out an old tire from the corner of the barn. She went to her workbench. She scanned its length. Peter's cheeks burned as she turned to him.
"Did you take my knife?"
Her voice had turned dangerous, like something that could burst into flame and peel the roof off the barn. Peter felt dizzy, and his heart began to thud again. He pulled the knife out and handed it to her.
"Why?"
Peter swallowed hard. His words were gone.
"Why?"
"Because... okay, because I was afraid you might kill me."
"Kill you?"
She eyed him hard.
"What? Because I live out in the woods, that makes me a murderer?"
Peter raised a shoulder toward the wall of bladed tools.
"My tools? I have 20 acres of trees to care for, and I'm a woodcarver. You thought they were weapons?"
Peter looked away, ashamed.
"Look at me, boy."
He turned back.
"Maybe you are not wrong," she said, locking his gaze. "Maybe you see something."
"Maybe I am." She raised her hands slowly, pinched her fingers together in front of Peter's face, then suddenly flicked them open.
Boom! "Dangerous, like that. No warning."
Peter flinched.
"No, I'm sorry. I was wrong."
Vola shot a palm at him and spun away. She cut 4 strips of rubber from the tire, then wrapped them around the crutch tops and grips and secured them with twine in silence. She held the crutches out. Peter placed one under each arm and eased himself to the floor. It was an immediate comfort to be upright and balanced, with his injured foot safely tucked up.
"Take your weight on your palms. Lift yourself, don't hang.
Plant the crutches, then swing through." Peter began to thank her, but Vola cut him off again.
"At the end of my road is the highway. Head left, and in a quarter of a mile you'll come to a gas station.
You figure it out from there." She helped him into his backpack and then turned away, picked up a block of wood, and began to shave off slices as if he were no longer in the barn. Peter tried to step toward the door. He wobbled a little, but not much.
"That was a hop," Vola said without looking up. "I said swing through. Now get out of here."
For a moment, Peter didn't move. He didn't know where he was headed, only that it sure wasn't back to his grandfather's. Vola turned and leaned toward him, pinched her fingers together, and shot them out at him again. Go, while you're still safe.
Chapter 9. Approaching the meadow from the forest above, Gray stopped suddenly, nose in the air.
Again.
He lifted his muzzle to test the scent more carefully.
Stronger.
Pax already hesitant, tensed. Gray hurried to the edge of the trees.
A loner is challenging me. He wants this territory. But his display is for the young vixen's benefit. She will choose a mate this winter.
Pax followed and took in the scene below him. Four foxes dotted the meadow. Bristle and Runt stood together, their black-tipped ears pricked forward warily toward the other two, who faced each other on a ledge of rock, halfway down. One of these was a vixen, darker than Bristle and big-bellied with kits. The other was a large male with rough, tawny fur. His hackles were up and his left ear was split. Gray barked to announce his presence. The challenger spun off the ledge, an arc of blood spraying from his ear, and bolted down the meadow. Gray picked his way down the hillside, Pax following. As Gray passed Bristle and Runt, his very presence seemed to calm them, as if he were an unseen hand stroking their backs. As soon as he passed, Runt danced his excitement at seeing Pax, but Bristle curled a lip and hissed. Pax hurried after Gray. When Gray climbed to the ledge beside his mate, Pax dropped to its base and sat, respectful. Gray's mate greeted him with affection. Then she shared news.
The wind this morning was from the west. It brought the scent of fire. We must move soon.
She looked out at Pax.
The outsider smells of humans.
Bristle and Runt edged closer, ears cocked toward Gray's response.
He is returning to the humans he lived with in the south. I will travel with him, to search for a suitable place to move. He and I will rest, then leave tonight.
Behind him, Bristle growled again, and Pax felt the urge to run.
His boy. He wanted only to find his boy, but instinct told him that he needed rest and food first.
He signaled his agreement, and then Gray and his mate glided silently into the green meadow.
Runt bounded over and tumbled into Pax. He dropped the toy soldier from his cheek, inviting Pax to play.
Bristle jumped between them and swatted the toy away.
Humans, remember the danger.
Runt retrieved the toy and displayed it between his teeth, defiant. Pax sensed that Runt was now in more trouble than before, and that he was the cause. He'd felt that way often with his boy and the father, and one of his strategies had been to disappear, if that would protect his boy from the man's anger. He backed away, but Bristle was not satisfied.
Stay away from the human stinker, she warned her brother. Remember the danger.
Pax took a step closer.
My humans are not dangerous.
Runt seemed alarmed by this, as if Pax had issued a challenge. He darted uphill toward his den entrance, but his sister was quicker. She blocked him, and when he tried to slink away in another direction, she restrained him with a heavy paw until he stilled in defeat.
All humans are dangerous.
Pax's fur ruffled in a shiver at the scene Bristle conjured then. Wind, cold, and howling and heavy with the threat of snow.
Pax recognized that wind.
The story she was about to relate would end with blood on the snow and cold steel jaws.
Bristle bared her fangs at Pax,
and then began. Chapter 10. At the jog in the wall where he'd seen the deer, Peter stopped. There was blood already. He'd stumbled and ripped open the tender web of skin at the base of his thumb on a jagged splinter, and buckets of sweat. His arms trembled from the strain of lifting his weight for only these few minutes. His palms already raw on the rubber grips, and the throbbing in his right foot menaced like thunder. But none of that was what was wrong. It wasn't even the prospect of returning to his grandfather's grim house. He was going in the wrong direction. He wheeled around. He stabbed the ground and swung over it, stabbed and swung, until he planted himself in the doorway of Vola's barn again. He drew himself up tall.
No.
Vola's head snapped up. She shot him a warning scowl, but on her face, Peter read a flash of something else. Fear.
I'm not going back,
he said, more firmly.
Whether you help me or not, I'm going to get my fox.
Help you?
Peter moved to the bench and hoisted himself up.
Teach me. What you said about moving from my arms. About getting strong.
You learned how to get around on one leg.
Teach me. You were a medic. Set my bone, please.
I'll do whatever you tell me to. He picked up the cider and drank it down to show his trust.
Then I'll leave. But even if you won't help me, I'm going to get him.
Vola put her hands on her hips and lowered her head to eye him.
A tamed fox set loose in the wild? You know he might be dead, don't you?
I know. And it would be my fault. If he's dead, I need to bring him home and bury him.
Either way, I'm going to go back and find my fox and bring him home.
Vola studied Peter as if she were seeing him for the first time.
So which is it? You going back for your home, or for your pet?
They're the same thing, Peter said. The answer sudden and sure, although a surprise to him.
And you're going to do this no matter who tries to stop you, because it's the right thing for you at your core.
Vola made a fist and thumped her chest.
Your core. Is that true?
Peter waited before answering, because this woman, maybe crazy, maybe not, had asked it as if the fate of the world depended on it. But the answer was the same as it would have been if he'd blurted it out. The answer would have been the same if he'd waited a lifetime to think it over. He thumped his own chest and felt the muscle of his heart leap.
Yes.
In fact, there's nothing else I know at my core.
The woman nodded.
Well, you're 12. That's old enough to know your own self, I expect.
I'm not about to go messing with that, so all right.
You'll help me?
I'll help you.
Vola extended her hand to shake.
On three conditions.
Chapter 11.
My brother was born in my mother's second litter. They came early in the season. Last year, spring came late. Snow fell and it did not melt. The earth stayed frozen beneath it. I lived nearby. I helped hunt. All day long our parents and I searched for food, because the kits were always hungry, but there was never enough. Two of his littermates died on the same day. The farm, our mother urged. At the human's farm, there were always fat mice in the warm barn. At the human's farm, there were eggs in the chicken coop. Our father would not risk it. When her third kit grew too weak to stand, our mother defied him. Runt raised his head and gave Bristle a pleading look. Bristle ignored it. She led the strongest of her new kits, my sister, and me to the human's farm. Runt edged closer and pressed his nose into Pax's shoulder. Instantly the vixen lashed at his cheek, although Pax noted she did not use her claws. Runt dropped to the ground. The ground around the barn was cleared of snow by many footprints, animal as well as human. The air was rich with the smell of rodents. Our mother headed for a gap in the wooden boards near the base, with us a few tail lengths behind. Just before she reached it, steel jaws sprang out of the earth with such speed that the air snapped. Our mother screamed. The clamp held her front leg. The more she thrashed, the deeper the metal cut. She began biting at her leg to free it. Every time we tried to come near, she ordered us away. Our father appeared. He had followed our tracks. He chased my sister and me back into the brush and ordered us to stay there. Then he set to helping our mother. The scene she conveyed was of two foxes, bonded by both an old love and a new fear. The fear so terrible, their eyes rolled back in their sockets, so vivid that Pax could smell its sharp scent. Runt began to whimper, a piteous sound that made Pax want to comfort him,
but Bristle warned him to keep away.
A human came then, with a stick. Both our parents screamed at us to run home. We stayed. We saw.
The human raised the stick, and in front of our eyes, our mother and our father burst into blood and fur and shattered bones spattered over the snow.
Runt whined and backed away toward the den again, and again Bristle stopped him. My sister and I could not leave our parents' bodies.